You're listening to episode 367 of the New World Order. This is Class 2, and in this episode, I'm going to talk about Debian, which I don't normally talk about, to be honest, because it's not really something that I choose to run most often. It's not my go-to distribution. My go-to distribution, as you may know if you listen to this podcast frequently, is Slackware. And I'll admit that after Slackware, my fallback Linux distribution would probably be something like Red Hat or Fedora, but that doesn't change how I feel about Debian, which is that it's an amazing project, and it happens to be on 16 August, happens to be Debian's birthday. They're something like 27 years old as of this recording, which is pretty impressive, I think. I think it's time maybe to talk about Debian a little bit, because there are lots of things that I really, really like about Debian, and I want to kind of convey why it's such a significant and important project. So, number one, first of all, it has been around a long time. And that's it. That's no small feat. The fact, I mean, you know, on one hand, you think, well, it's kind of arbitrary how long it's been around. I mean, something happens to be around 27 years versus 10 years, I mean, versus 5 years. What's the big deal? It's just that there are lots of factors that go into that. For instance, you might, at some point, you could have said, well, Mandriva is a wonderful and time-honored distribution. It's been around for a long time. I mean, heck, I guess you could still say that. You could say something like, oh, Magia has been around since 1998, which is when Mandrake was created, or released, rather. And I guess technically you would be correct, but there is something different about being able to say, now, Debian, this project has been around 27 years. The processes that they have established and the way that they do things and the structure that they have created, the infrastructure and the philosophy behind what they're doing, that's been around since 1993, which was like, what, 2 years after Linux itself was released? I mean, it's like the kernel. I mean, it's a big, big deal. Now, a couple of years ago, I did a project for myself where I took myself through Linux history in, I don't know, a week or two or three, and I went way, 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 way back into the archives and took old releases, but early releases of all the major distributions that I could think of, and just kind of went through from like 1992 to 3 to 4 to 6 to 8, you know, skipped a couple, but generally just kind of got a feel for the 90s, got a feel for the early 2000s, up at least I think until, I don't know, 2006 or so, which is kind of when I started my Linux journey. So at that point, I didn't need to recreate it because I'd lived it, but I did that and it was a lot of fun. And one of the second oldest one that I tried was Debian. I started with Slackware and then went to Debian and installed them into virtual machines, you know, and kind of got them up and running, just kind of poked around and tried to see what they were all about. And I have to say that Debian, even way, way back then, it's I think it was the initial release or maybe the second release, it was a really, really nice little distribution. I mean, it felt like an OS that had been around for a while, and obviously it kind of had, right, because Unix was around, so they knew what they were aiming for, and they were able to recreate it relatively easy because there were all the GNU utilities, and then there was the kernel, and everything had been kind of been set out for them, and they assembled those pieces and called themselves Debian. But logging into that system, I was surprised at how good it felt, like how familiar it felt to someone who'd been using Linux for many, many years by that time, and also just someone familiar with sort of Unix in general. Logging into that system, I feel like I must have gotten a slight sense of what it must have been like for people back then to log into Debian, you know, desktop Linux, and think, or I guess it wouldn't have been desktop Linux, I guess wouldn't have been the term, but you know, like 386 Unix, except it was Linux. It must have been a big deal, right? Because I mean, here it is, you download it, you install it, and you're just thinking, oh, this is it, this is Unix. I mean, it was brilliant. It was really, really nice. And it's continued from that point, you know, from starting out feeling like a well-worn distribution and then continuing and developing. I mean, I forget when DPKG was integrated into it. It might have been in the release that I tried, actually. It was a very different sort of beast at that point, but it was there. You know, this concept of package management was already there. And they just, they took all of these concepts and it developed and grew and became something different and something unique. And there is something to be said for that because it shows a constant trajectory, and that's what Debian has going for it, is this constant sort of, the Debian way. Like, this is how we do things in the Debian distribution. This is the philosophy behind it. This is the cadence of releases. This is the life cycle of development. It's very impressive and not to be taken as lightly as I think it's kind of easy to take it sometimes if you because initially you want to just kind of see everything as equally valid, but in terms of years. But there is something to be said for something that has been able to continue for 27 years or longer. So it's a big deal that they've been around a long time. It is significant, and I think it adds a little bit to that sense of security that one has when one looks at Debian. When you look at their, you know, when you're pondering Debian as an option, you just kind of think, yep, that's Debian. I know if I choose that one, that would be a safe choice. There's such security in that sort of that sense of relief of just, I don't have to worry about this. I can choose them, and I know that 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, 15 years, I'll have made the right choice because they'll still be there, they'll still be going, they'll still be basically the same. Let's go with that. Okay, second point I wanted to make was that it's apparently easy to remix, and this is something that I would love to know more about because I don't know if this feature of Debian is a technical feature, an organizational feature, or just a purely legal feature. I would really love to hear someone from Debian explain or theorize why it is that Debian is the, I feel like it's kind of the de facto choice of a distro remix. Now, my feelings about distros, about the concept of the Linux distribution aside, and that is, by the way, I don't love it. I don't love that Linux has the concept of distributions and remixes of distributions. I mean, I love it because it means that people are being creative and free to be creative and so on. I don't love it as a thing because I think that there are more efficient ways to say, hey, here's my version of Linux, which would, for the record, it would be install scripts or build scripts or theme packs and things like that. Anyway. Oh, and package managers that are completely separate from from their foundation. But anyway, apparently Debian's easy to remix, and that's got to be a good thing because if you really, really think about what that means, it means that Debian is okay with being a support for others, and that's a really, really hard thing to do. I mean, if you think about it, you don't have to think too hard about it because it's pretty obvious. But Ubuntu was pretty famous for a while, and I mean, Ubuntu probably really, I mean, they made the biggest dent, I think, in public awareness of Linux out of anybody so far. And well, maybe. No, I think that, yeah, I think it's safe to say that. I think because I mean, people who just don't even know what an OS is, they've heard of Ubuntu, and that's a huge service to the community, frankly. That's some good marketing. But it couldn't have been easy for Debian, who built everything that Ubuntu sort of took and slapped some polish onto. They built all that stuff, and they didn't really get a whole lot of press in return. Ubuntu was paying for marketing. Ubuntu got the press attention. People didn't know the name Debian. People don't even know how to say the name Debian, much less that the word exists at all. Ubuntu got all of that, and that can't be easy, but it's huge. It's a huge sort of sacrifice, really, to be able to work quietly on something while a bunch of other people make a lot of noise over in the corner and they're getting all that attention and you're just toiling away, shoveling your work into their marketing machine. It's got to be a little bit tough, and there are arguments on both sides of this sort of this made up, well, not made up, but this slightly hyperbolic drama that I'm relaying here. Obviously, Ubuntu has contributed back to Debian, and Debian contributes to Ubuntu in the sense that they're building Debian. So, there are lots of different sides of this coin. All I'm saying is that Debian serves as the basis for Ubuntu, and that's a big deal. They also serve as basis for distributions like Elementary OS, which is kind of the new hotness, and much deservedly so. Elementary OS is really, really nice, but it's built on Debian. They're the foundation for Linux Mint, which kind of I think among enthusiasts has kind of taken some of the hype away from Ubuntu in recent years, but I don't think by any means that they've captured that kind of same sort of pop culture zeitgeist that Ubuntu managed to get. Pop OS, I guess, is technically based on Debian. That's the System 76 OS. But then there are others that are maybe even more surprising. For instance, Steam OS, which is Valve's operating system upon which they built their Steam-centric operating system, I guess. And well, their Steam distribution, I guess, which was going to be the OS, or is the OS, I guess, for Steam machines, which we kind of thought that was going to enter the console market, and sort of the console wars didn't really happen. Not really sure to this day what Valve's game plan is there, but luckily this isn't an episode about Valve, so I don't have to theorize. So there's SteamOS based on Debian. Originally it was based on Ubuntu, but they decided to just flip all the way back to Debian, and that's what they're basing it on to this day. Slacks, which was built previously upon, as the name suggests, Slackware, rather recently decided that it was just kind of easier to maintain it if they based it on Debian. Actually, that's not exactly. I should probably get the exact quote or something, but I don't know where to find it offhand. But I think the packages of Debian was a big persuasion thing for rebasing Slacks onto Debian. I believe that was one of the things that Thomas, the maintainer of Slacks, cited. It's just that with Debian you inherit, tens of thousands of packages, whereas with Slackware you only get whatever's in Slackware and slackbuilds.org. So that might have been a big part of that. But the point remains, I think, which is Debian's remixable. Debian is a foundational kind of technology. Whether Debian sort of means to be or not, and like I said, I don't know if it's a technological thing where they've organized their init sequence or their init process in such a way that it's just easier to sort of build off of that to make your remix, or whether it's purely a legal thing where it happens to be that because it's licensed in such a way, or all the packages that they're using are licensed in certain ways, so you can count on it being a safe thing to remix, or whether it's simply because when you decide to remix Debian, you don't have to go through any kind of legal things in order to get permission. I don't know. I don't know the reasoning. I would not mind hearing about more of that from someone involved with Debian, but I haven't really looked into it because I don't care ultimately. The point is that the results kind of speak for themselves, and that is that people like to build on Debian. And that's a big gift that the Debian community grants to Linux, to Linux desktop users and server users. It's just here's this thing, and if you want to change it into your own thing, you're free to do so. Okay, so my third point is kind of related to all of this, and that is that Debian is relatively ownerless. So when I say that, things like, oh, Debian must have been hard for Debian to see Ubuntu getting all the press. Well, who's Debian? Debian isn't owned by anyone. It has a project lead or a project manager or whatever, there's no one person who sort of owns and orders people around within Debian. And the magnitude of that is a little bit difficult to understand unless you really kind of get to know other projects well enough to recognize the difference. And I mean, you can't look at Slackware by any means and say that no one owns Slackware, because someone definitely owns Slackware, and that would be Patrick Volkerding. He's the guy maintaining Slackware. There are ways to contribute to that by making contact with him and filing bug reports on linuxquestions.org and so on. But there's ultimately one captain on this ship, and that is Patrick Volkerding. Ubuntu is the same way, or it was the same way when they were still doing desktop stuff. Well, I guess they're still doing desktop stuff, but I don't know how big of a deal within the organization that is anymore. But they have Mark Shuttleworth, who's steering that ship. I mean, that if something if there's a question as to whether something needs to be sort of to get focus in Ubuntu, then Mark Shuttleworth gets to decide that ultimately. And the same thing really sort of goes for Fedora. I mean, Fedora is it has governance and it has a board of people who are some of whom work at Red Hat, some of who intentionally do not work at Red Hat. So you've got that intentional split, but there's still there's the Red Hat presence on the board, and there are lots of Red Hat people working at Red Hat, working on Fedora as well. And so it's the nature of a business is that if you want something done without question, and usually pretty quickly, because you get to tell people to focus on that thing for all day until they get it done, then in the modern world, the way that you do that is you throw money at it. And so if you have an entity that's throwing money at something, then there's whether there's governance or not, there's a concentrated effort being driven and motivated by something external than sort of the quote unquote purity of just having spare time and hacking on it whenever you like. And as cool as it is to hack on something just whenever you're in the mood to do that, it has blockades to it. I mean, if you cannot afford in a moment to work on that side project, then it doesn't get done. So in Fedora and in Ubuntu and in SUSE and all these big distributions that have some kind of corporate sponsorship, that happens because someone is able to pay other people to work on a thing for them. It's perfectly acceptable. I'm not criticizing that. I think that it's a great way to get certain things done relatively quickly. Sometimes things happen relatively quickly just because people are. They're very passionate about it, they have time, and they all come together and do it, and it happens. But other times that's not how it occurs, and someone has to pay for it, and the people paying for it are going to be Red Hat, Canonical, or SUSE. Now, in Debian, that does not exist. Luckily, because it's open source, Debian can benefit from some of that. I mean, there's plenty of technology out there that I don't think would have, if it had just been up to Debian to create it from scratch and to get it done and to get it integrated, it would have either not happened or it would have taken a lot longer to happen. But there are huge benefits in modern Linux that exists in Debian right now because someone else paid for it. But the Debian project itself, they don't have anyone driving I guess an agenda within Debian, which it sounds like a benefit, but it's also kind of a scary thing. I mean, if you really look at it analytically, you sometimes someone driving an agenda is important. I mean, that provides focus and clarity and it directs energy towards something that needs to be done. So I mean, that can be a good thing sometimes, but Debian doesn't have that. It doesn't have that external force saying, hey, Debian or fellow Debian creators, we need to all focus on this thing so that this happens. So the fact that it's ownerless, that the people don't have full control over where Debian is going, is actually kind of a scary thing. I mean, if you just think about how many cooks can be in a kitchen or how many people ought to be driving one vehicle, you just don't think of it as being something that is generally a desirable thing. But there are so many, obviously, moving parts to Debian, so many things that people can work on. As long as that all filters up into, we're going to end up with a distribution that boots, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And it's, I think, very indicative of why anarchism does work so well in software. This kind of well-defined goal and all of these different parts that need to go into creating that goal, no matter who or where it's being done, who's doing it or where it's getting done at, doesn't really matter as long as in the end everything's building correctly and booting correctly and so on. And obviously there is a structure in Debian. It's not total anarchy, as in you can't just wander into a server and make a commit and then wander out. You know there's a packaging. There are packagers, and you have to sort of prove yourself to them and get permission to do things without approval of others. You know, I mean, that all sort of that makes sense. That kind of that sort of chain of command, or those divisions of authority, makes perfect sense. That kind of microcosmic ownership over, I guess, domain ownership, it makes sense, and it's kind of how things would need to happen. But the truth still remains that there's no owner, there's no project owner, there's a project manager, and those are two totally different things. And I learned this initially, actually, from the Fedora project, bizarrely, from Paul Friel specifically, because I got to see Paul a lot at some conferences for a while, and it just kind of struck me, trying to define exactly what it was that Paul did, and it kind of hit me that Paul, doesn't do anything really as Fedora project lead. I mean, he's no longer the Fedora project lead. He's still involved with Fedora, but he's not the project lead. That's Matthew Miller as of this recording. But these lead roles in some of these software domains, they're not sitting down and writing code, for instance. They're not directing people. They're really it's a reactionary kind of position where you look at what's happening, and maybe you help communicate between teams, and you help remind people of different goals and milestones and so on. But you're not actually directing anything. And I can only imagine how someone coming from traditional management would be able to wrap their head around that reality of not being able to order people around, but still having to make all of those things work together. And Debian does that on a massive scale. There's no body driving. It's everyone driving towards a common goal that has been defined previously. And the communication happens, and it's facilitated by a project manager, but no one is the boss of you. That's a huge, huge innovation that really I think Linux is able to kind of brag about, and certainly Debian, I guess arguably most of all. And the fourth point, I think I'm on point number four, is one of the really, really big points, one of the important points, I think. And this is the it's the point that really sort of made me think, you know what, I should talk about Debian. And that is that Debian is the large scale, massive embodiment of desktop Linux. And it might be a little bit strange for me to say that because, as I've said, I don't use Debian all that often. I mean, I do if it's the thing that runs on a computer, right? I mean, like, if there's a computer that only runs essentially Debian, then I run Debian. And I guess that's actually point number four. Point number four is the architecture support. The architecture support behind Debian is amazing. If you have a computer that needs to run and you can't find any other modern OS that it can respond to, go to Debian. They support all the architectures, and it's astonishing what boots Debian. I mean, it's basically the NetBSD of Linux. Like, you can think, what Linux would this run? First thing off the top of your head should be Debian. It will run Debian. If nothing else, it'll run Debian. And that's really, really, really significant because, especially in this day and age of so much technological waste, we call it e-waste at the time of this recording, it's just horrible to throw something away that actually boots. I mean, if the thing powers on, it should not be going into a bin. So Debian can bring that thing back to life. And it frankly, if it turns, if it powers on, then it shouldn't be running something other than Linux or BSD, if you please. But it should be running free software, open source software. And Debian is kind of, it would be the go-to. It would be the one that you could say, yep, it'll run that. So that one, I think, is probably honestly one of my, well, I appreciate a lot of these things, actually. I was going to say that's the thing I appreciate most, but it's going to be a tough call. So point five then is the thing that made me think to do this episode, which was that it is desktop Linux. And when I say that, what I'm trying to say is that it is the stalwart industry lead, without even being in the industry, for providing a desktop experience for Linux. I mean, if you look at all the major players out there who are in the industry, they've all dropped. Well, they haven't dropped, but they've all quietly meandered away from desktop Linux. You look at Ubuntu. They used to be the loudest and proudest of desktop providers. I mean, that was their thing, right? Linux for humans. And you went to their site, and they made it very clear that you were to download Ubuntu onto your and install it on your personal computer, your PC. They don't really do that anymore. They've shifted their attentions to server technology, for actually to cloud technology specifically. And you can tell if you go to their site, it's pretty clear. Red Hat famously, many, many years ago, back in 2005 or 6, dropped Red Hat. There is no Red Hat Linux anymore. You might think that there's Red Hat Linux, but actually what there is Red Hat Enterprise Linux, and that is very different than Red Hat Linux. So RHEL, Red Hat Enterprise Linux, they do provide desktops, and you can even get a support contract for it. So it's there, but if you go to their site, you'd never know it. You have to really dig around for it. And famously, what they did back in, I don't know, 2005, 2006, whatever it was, is that they released Red Hat Linux, or they rather, they stopped releasing Red Hat Linux, and they declared that Fedora was going to be the community-supported desktop Linux distribution sponsored by Red Hat. And that's what Fedora is. It is the or ostensibly, that's what Fedora is. I mean, I think I would argue, and do argue very often, that Fedora is not really that. It's not the consumer grade desktop Linux that you really want to promote, because I mean it's being updated like almost daily. Like it's changing. It's almost a rolling release without being a rolling release. So I don't think Fedora is exactly, you wouldn't go to the store and pay 100 or 200, whatever an OS costs these days, for a Fedora disk, because it would just shift around from out from under you all the time, constant updates. Now, to Fedora, many Fedora users, myself included, back when I was doing this, that's a feature, right? Like these constant updates mean that you have the latest version of the software all the time, and it's pretty neat. It's pretty cool to be on the cutting edge like that. But it also means that you're on the cutting edge. So Red Hat, Ubuntu, they've both functionally dropped support for the desktop. SUSE is pretty good. They've stayed in the game in terms of actually acknowledging that some people want a desktop. But yeah, Ubuntu and Red Hat certainly have kind of meandered away. And I think there's an argument that SUSE, that even SUSE, business-wise, they really do concentrate on the server space pretty heavily in the cloud space. And I think that's my point, is that corporate Linux these days, I mean, look at the Linux Foundation. The CEO, or whatever he calls himself, of the Linux Foundation, brings a Mac to every event that he attends. Like he's never on a Linux computer, and he has gone on record saying that desktop Linux just isn't what matters. So corporate involvement of Linux on a desktop machine, like your laptop or your the computer sitting on your desk, whatever, it's basically not it, that's not a market. That is not a market that really, really exists. You got people giving it their best effort. You got System 76 with Pop! OS trying to do their darndest to make really, really, and they do great. I mean, they make amazing computers, and they provide an amazing desktop experience. But they're not obviously they're not quite a canonical yet, or a Red Hat. So corporate Linux involvement, it has walked away from the desktop experience. If you want a PC with Linux on it, companies out there working on Linux don't have a whole lot to offer you. Whereas Debian continues to be Debian for desktops, for servers, for the cloud. It doesn't matter. They're concentrating on using Linux on your PC. They're concentrating on making sure that you have a desktop in front of you that is up to date and modern. And that's a big, big deal, because it is an example of where capitalism has utterly failed. Right? Capitalism says, okay, well, we wanted this thing, we wanted this desktop experience, but we don't feel like the numbers are there for whatever reason. I mean, I guess ultimately it boils down to dollars, but for whatever reason, the numbers aren't where we need them to be to continue that effort. So we're going to walk away from it. And they have. They've noticeably done that. And Debian, with its massive community and massive developer base, has picked up the slack. And that's an amazing, amazing service to the whole Linux community. I mean, I'm not saying that without Debian there would be no desktop Linux. That's silly. I mean, obviously I'm running and using right now Slackware Linux. So I'm not saying that there would be no Linux desktop without Debian. I'm simply saying that they are maintaining they remain a force for desktop Linux, and that's an important role to play, because that's what a community is all about. Is when these little fake little structures that we construct, that we build up for ourselves, like businesses and corporations that are supposed to be sort of useful, when they falter, when they fail to deliver something, you'd better have a solid community behind you, ready to provide that service instead. And Debian has. Okay, so we're going to take a coffee break, because that's what we do. And then we'll come back, and I'm going to talk about stability, because I have lots of thoughts about stability in Okay, I've got my coffee, and wanted to talk about stability with my coffee. So stability is one of those things that people kind of throw around in the Linux world, because while everyone knows that your OS is supposed to be stable, and no one knows it quite like a systems administrator, but everyone sort of likes the idea of stability. No one exactly knows what stability means, however, they just know it's a good thing. And this is for good reason. It's a complex concept, stability. I mean, stability, when you initially hear the word, I feel like you think, okay, stable means, in software terms, not crashing. So you think, okay, so if I have Debian, it will never crash. And I think that's a fair assessment. That's a fair initial reaction to that term. Stability means your software won't crash. That's good enough. That works. Debian, stable, won't crash often. Yeah, we could broadly make that assumption. To be fair, we could broadly make that assumption about a lot of Linuxes, to be honest, in my experience. I don't know if that's the most important expression of Debian's strong features, is that it is quote-unquote stable, because it's a Linux kernel. It's hard to crash the Linux kernel. I mean, that's not a challenge. I'm not saying go out and try it. I'm just saying it tends to, outside of a kernel panic, you don't tend to, it doesn't really crash all that often. Applications running on top of that kernel could crash. So now, is that part of the term stability? Well, actually, yeah, it is. And if you look at the Debian life cycle, you realize that it is able to be seen as a stable thing, because they don't make changes frequently throughout the course of its support. So you install, let's say you install Debian 10 for 5 years or whatever, whenever the next one's ready. For a very long span of time, you don't see many changes. There are some updates, there are some upgrades here and there. There are certainly security patches, but generally speaking, you install the thing, and that is your OS for several years. And they're able to say that that is stable, because when you turn on the computer in 2018, it is functionally the same as when you then turn it on in 2020. And that's a beautiful thing. And that's what I personally expect out of my operating system, to be honest. I think a lot of Linux users, we go through phases. And certainly when you first discover Linux, I think especially, because a lot of times discovering Linux is also the time that you're discovering sort of like, oh my gosh, I can play around on computers. I can do all kinds of things on computers. I didn't know I could do that. Kind of discovering the hackability of a computer, because you've discovered Linux and everything's open. These two things become a little bit conflated, and you think, well, what I want to do on a computer is just play on the computer. So if something works one day and then stops working the next day because it got updated, and something has changed, well, in a way, nothing could be more fun for you. It's like a puzzle every day. It's like a new challenge, because you launched your music player on Monday and it worked perfectly all day, and then on Tuesday you launched it and it's crashing every 10 minutes. That's weird. What could it be? Why don't you try to fix it? And then on Wednesday it's working again, because you fixed it on Tuesday, and then on Thursday it got updated again and now it won't even launch. Well, that's weird. Why don't you go try to fix that? So it's a lot of fun. That instability is just, it's a lot entertaining. It's a game. And that's, I mean, certainly that's how I felt about Fedora for a very long time. I just loved the instability of Fedora. I loved the fact that they would throw updates at you every week, multiple times a week. And I just thought that was so cool. But then as a Linux user, you eventually sort of, maybe you start to mellow out a little bit. Maybe you start to focus on something. You're focusing on development, or you're focusing on making multimedia, or maybe you're unfocused and you try to do both. Not that I know anyone like that, but you're doing different things. You're no longer exploring just like the fact that you can fix things on your computer when they break. You're now trying to use your computer to do things. And so those little breakages, those little quirks here and there, they start to become less fun because now they're keeping you from doing the new things that you want to focus on. And I think when you reach that point, if you reach that point, not everyone does, people are different, you might never focus on something and you might just say, well, I really just enjoy using Linux and I don't mind these little breakages because it gives me an excuse to learn new stuff and how to fix stuff. And then you're a domain expert on those little quirks, like how do you fix this? Oh, that's an RC file in your in your home.local/config, blah blah. Or, well, it wouldn't be config in local, it would be .local/maybe share, whatever it might be. So you don't necessarily ever grow out of that. But if you do grow out of that and the breakages and the quirks and the little things start to become an annoyance, then you start looking for something quote unquote stable so that you can do things that are more important to you than other things. And Debian provides that. Debian gives you that option. Now you can go to Debian, what is it, SID, I think, right? The SID is always breaking toys or something. So SID, you can go to Debian SID and run that, and then maybe you'll get some of those breakages. You can start helping develop Debian. You know, you can report the bugs when they happen. You can fix things and submit patches and so on. But you also always have the option of not running Debian SID, and you're running just Debian, and it is stable. So to me, I guess stable means that you have a foundation that does not change often. And I think the ideal scenario, the ideal setup, at least for me, is that you've got a foundation that doesn't change frequently, but you are designed such that you enable selective instability as the user may need it. So in other words, you can provide people a foundation that's going to be the same from week to week, from year to year. But those little things that they want to run on top of that foundation can go crazy. They can do whatever they want to with those pieces. And sometimes that's a difficult thing. And I think, to be fair, I think that a lot of Linux distributions struggle with that. And frankly, I think Debian has traditionally struggled with that as well. They've got apt that's pretty tightly bound into their operating environments. They don't, you know, if you want to get wild and crazy with an application on Debian, then you can go to Debian, you can apt install it with apt, but you're getting that stable version, the old one, the one that doesn't change. It's part of the foundation. There's a conflict. You got the stable foundation, which you want, but you want the ability to do whatever you want with that one application or with that one set of applications. But as I've found lately, Debian and RHEL, CentOS, Slackware, a lot of these sort of traditionally very, or famously rather, very stable platforms, these stable foundations, have kind of inherited these cool abilities to separate the stable foundation from the opt-out of stability platform that you're actually running. And the way that I've done this recently, and I've talked about this in previous episodes too, how I do this with RHEL, I've got the OS and it is stable, and there's a bunch of stuff in the repository, and maybe there's not a bunch of stuff in the repository. In the case of RHEL and CentOS, you're kind of wanting for applications, to be honest. They don't have the, you know, 50,000 software packages that Debian is able to boast. So you've got this stable foundation with either packages that are way too stable, and that's happened for me with Debian. I mean, there have been things where Debian's been great on a Pi or on some Pi-like device or some old laptop, and then I want to install the latest version of some application, and you just realize that they don't have that version. They're way behind, like 3 years behind, and you think, well, why have they not updated this application? Well, it's because they're stable, and they're famously stable, and they don't just go in and willy-nilly change applications because because that, you know, they don't know that that's the one application that you would really prefer to have updated for you. So it doesn't happen. That's when the word stable starts to sound a lot more like old and crusty and out of date, grumpy terms like that. There are new systems that have come around recently, some so new that they are, I don't know, 10 or 20 years old. Lately, what I've been doing with Debian boxes and is I'll install the stable OS onto the computer. On top of that, I lay a very thin veneer of package source, and I place very carefully a pleasant design of Flatpak and or Snapcraft. So if you have no idea what I just said, package source I've covered in a previous episode. Package source is a repository of software managed by the NetBSD folk. It's a pretty sizable repository. I think I saw the number 40,000, but I could have only seen, I don't know, 20,000. I don't know. It was a lot. It was a big number. There's a lot of software in there. It is aware that it could be built for BSD, for Linux, for other operating systems as well. The make files are quite sane. That's not to say that they always work. I will say that. I will say that not everything always works as expected without any modification. And there are things that are missing. You're going to find something that's not in package source. Package source, by the way, if you want to check it out, is pkgsrc.org. Package source. The setup is, I would say, non-trivial. I mean, once you do it, it's non-trivial, but understanding the difference between how package source works and how apt or DNF works, you have to step back and kind of learn some new concepts. The nice thing about package source is that by nature, it confines itself to /user/local. That's its environment. And so you can have, for instance, your stable foundation, your base of Debian on a computer. And you know that that foundation functionally is basically not going to change. Like everything there is going to pretty much stay the same from 2018 to 2022 or 2028, who knows? That won't change. You'll get essential updates, it'll get some updates here and there, but it's going to lag behind all the development that you see in the world, and mostly you're not going to ever care about that. Like, that's the thing that makes the computer turn on, you know, and that's fine. So that essentially is your kernel. You're now running a Debian kernel. I mean, not really, but you know what I mean? Like, that's the firmware. That's the read-only part of your OS. And then what I've done lately is I install package source, and I'll go into package source and I'll find something that I need. Let's say, I was going to say GIMP, but now I'm realizing I would do that with a Flatpak. So, well, I don't know, who cares? Let's call it foo. So you want to install foo, but you know that foo requires libpng. Now you see that on Debian you already have libpng, but it's version 0.12 or something, or 12 maybe, I don't know. And in package source it's 14, which is lucky because that's what foo requires, is libpng version 14, and you've only got 12 on the Debian system. So you might for a moment experience some discomfort because you think, oh, but I already have libpng installed. Well, don't worry about it. You're going to have two libpngs installed now. One is going to live in user local, and one is going to live out on your Debian system, and that's fine. Just be okay with the duplication. It'll make your life so much easier. And so I install foo and libpng 14 within the package source environment. And since I have user local bin in my path, as part of the installation process, then when I launch foo, it knows to launch foo out of user local, and it is built to look to the libpng that lives in user local, and so on. So it's all relatively self-contained. Not each application is self-contained, obviously, but it is, the user local environment is self-contained. It is an environment more or less of its own, and it has been making my software management, certainly on top of something that may not keep up with the latest editions of packages, quite nice. And it has been, it's kind of given me this stable but not super stable kind of ability to try out different software that maybe for whatever reason I don't like how Debian built it, or maybe I just need something more recent than what Debian has available. And that's the other thing, the package source thing is it does build from source, so you can get in there and make the modifications that you want. Now, previous to package source, I had been using a hacked together version of Slack package, Slack PKG, which I hacked together for Debian. I haven't used that in the past year, so I don't know what state it's in. It's on GitLab. I may look at that again. The kind of the quote unquote problem with Slack package on Debian is that Slack package assumes that you're running Slackware underneath, so it doesn't necessarily know to look for certain things, and it's harder to kind of like say, okay, well, Slack package, I need you to just sort of focus on these libraries in this location. I mean, you can do it, but it's a very manual process. Whereas package source, that's how it was built. It knows that it's going to live in user local or whatever prefix you define. You could put it in opt or whatever, but I just keep it in user local. And that's where its environment is, and it's quite nice. Now, for the really wild and wacky things, I turned to either Flatpak or Snapcraft. Snapcraft being the canonical implementation of this sort of self-contained application framework. Flatpak being the, I guess, generic slash GNOME-centric version of that. They both have their strengths. They both have their weaknesses. Actually, mostly Flatpak has its weaknesses. No, that's not true. Snap has a weakness, and it is canonical. But nothing against canonical. I just don't. I feel like canonical doesn't tend to stick with the projects that they start. So the long-term prospects of Snapcraft always make me nervous. But Snapcraft or Snap, whatever we're calling it these days, it is quite nice because it's running a daemon, and so it knows where to look when you type in a command. It knows, oh, this is the snap that you're looking for. Let me direct you over here to the snap framework rather than looking in your path and launching it out of there. So that is a kind of a nice feature. Flatpak still has this sort of really laborious way of launching an application. You have to do like Flatpak run and then the full string, the full domain, the reverse domain name of the project, like org.gimp, one in lowercase, one in capitals, and you'll never keep straight which is which. Either way, though, Flatpak and Snap, they both have this concept of support layers. And so when you install something like GIMP, then it knows, okay, well, you're installing like 2.10.18 of GIMP, so something very, very recent as of the time of this recording. So we need to update this set of libraries that we'll keep in slash var slash lib slash flatpak or whatever, so that this new version that you're running has all the libraries that it needs. So it's containing, it's installing applications essentially into a container on your computer, which means that you need a container, like a you need the stack of containers. So GIMP as a container isn't going to be able to run without the, I don't know, GNOME 3.28 SDK or whatever they're going to call it. So it can't run without those things, but because it knows exactly what it does need, someone can throw all of those libraries into a container and say, okay, well, anytime anyone installs GIMP, make sure that they also have this container so that that GIMP will launch and run. So it's all contained again, just like package source, only more so. And it's a great thing because you can go straight to an application that you care about and update it to the version that you decide that you need, independently of the operating system or the developers behind the operating system or the packagers more likely behind that operating system. And you can run as unstable just for that one application as you want without jeopardizing sort of the stability of the rest of your system. So it's an exciting little development. And I think that doing it this way, for me at least, has been a game changer. I mean, it really has changed, it shifted the way that I've been able to look at Debian, because the more I can stay out of apt, the better for me, for many reasons. I mean, not only because of the UX for me is not optimal, but also just because of that sort of that tight integration with the system. And the stability of Debian is something that I can appreciate and do appreciate, because mostly when I install an operating system that I like, what I see is what I like. Like that's the part that I like about that OS. The applications are separate. I don't want to have to sort of conflate those two together. I want those to be separate. And package source and Flatpak on top of something like Debian, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. It's flexible and yet stable. So if you have sort of trouble with some of the Debian stability aspects, if you look at their package selection and just think, oh, those version numbers are really, really old, give it a shot. Give it a go with package source and Flatpak. I'm not saying that package source is the end all and be all. In fact, I'm definitely not saying that. There are certain aspects of package source that just they don't really work all that well for me. But between the two, package source and flat pack, I've hit exactly the right mix of applications that I want to be more recent than what the base OS offers me, but maybe they're just, they don't need to be like cutting edge. I don't need the whole thing to be cutting edge. I just need them to be sort of reasonably recent. And I think package source does quarterly releases. And then flat pack for those things that I really just need to keep updated with that one application. It's been really, really nice. So give that a go if you're struggling with stability of Debian. And if you're not struggling with the stability of Debian, that's great because that is one of its main selling features. That's, I think, everything I have to say about Debian. Debian ought to be really, really proud of all of its accomplishments. And all of us Linux users, whether we use Debian on a daily basis or not, are greatly, greatly in its debt. So thanks, Debian, wherever you may be. Well, I guess it's nowhere, right? It's everywhere. Debian is everywhere. So thank you, Debian. Okay, that's it, folks. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Cast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @Klaatu at mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time. Yeah.